It was the fall of 1981. I was in the fourth grade. I was one of the first kids picked up by the school bus, and I was also one of the last kids dropped off. For some reason, they went the opposite direction. So I was on the bus over an hour each way, which meant I didn't get home from school until about 10 to 4, just in time to catch the last 10 minutes of General Hospital. Now, as a kid, I just started. That was the, if you remember anything about General Hospital, that was the season that Luke and Laura got married. You remember that? Okay. See? I love the last 10 minutes of General Hospital. There's so much tension, so much intrigue. That's when all the cliffhangers, every day was a cliffhanger to the next day. It was great. Well, then the school year ended and summer came around. I got to watch the whole hour and realized, wow, this is terrible. It's just drama. It's boring. Like, this person loves that person, but this person loves someone else, and this guy disrespected that guy, and then this woman was mad. It's like, girl, what you talking about? I mean, it was crazy, all the stuff that was going on. Like, this is, soap operas are not written for fourth graders. They continue to be very popular because people like drama, right? We like to see tension between people and figure out what's going on and who's going with whom and what's happening. But I would suggest this morning, if you need that much drama in your life, don't watch a soap opera. Read the Bible. You're going to find all kinds of drama and intrigue and family tensions and all those sorts of problems in Scripture. But in the messed up world of the Scriptures, instead of ending up with despair, we are greeted with a great sense of hope. You see, we're going to see this morning that the family of the patriarchs was a messed up family. Incredibly messed up. They had problems like you wouldn't, you would believe them because you're experiencing the same sorts of problems. So if you would, turn with me to Genesis chapter 27. If you have one of the black Bibles the church provides, it's page number 21. Genesis chapter 27, we're going to begin reading in the very first verse as we look at this incredible drama, this soap opera right here in the pages of Scripture. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." He said, "Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me delicious food, such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." Now the author says Isaac was old. At this point, he was about 130, which we would see as old, except Isaac's going to live for another 50 years. He doesn't die until he's 180. Now, he calls Esau to his bed, to his bedside. He wants to bless Esau. Now, we have to understand something about this blessing here. And that day, a man would bless his oldest son as the one who would receive the birthright. He would be the recipient of the majority of the man's stuff. He would wait until his deathbed, until he knew he was close to death, or until his son or he was about to leave on a long journey, which would not reunite them until long after death, right? They wouldn't see each other again. So 50 years before Isaac is going to die, he calls Esau, his older son, to his bedside in order to give him the blessing. He wanted to make sure the blessing went to Esau, not to Esau's younger twin brother. Now, so Isaac's old, but he's not nearly as old as he seems to be pretending to be. The author says his eyes they've dimmed, right? He's having trouble seeing. It may have been cataracts. He could have just had bad vision to begin with. Something, he's not able to see very well. A question for you. To whom did God give the promises of Abraham? Gave them to Isaac. And from Isaac, who did he give them to? Jacob, the younger son, right? We saw that. Turn back to Genesis chapter 25. Look there at verse 23. The Lord said to her, to Rebekah, as she was pregnant with twins, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." It was God's sovereign choice that the younger twin would be the one to inherit all the promises to Abraham. This was contrary to the normal course of things, and yet God is God and he can make those decisions. God chose the younger son, not the older son. Isaac, however, has a preference. He has a favorite. Who did Isaac call to his bedside to receive a blessing? Esau, the older brother. That's not the one God chose. God chose Jacob. Isaac chose Esau. And so he calls him to his bedside. Now, why would he do that? Why would it? Again, back in chapter 25, look at verse 27. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. See, Isaac has a favorite son, so does Rebekah. We'll see that in a bit. But let's focus on Isaac here. Isaac prefers Esau because Esau is a man's man, right? He's a tough guy. He likes to go hunting and fishing and camping. He likes to chop wood and watch football and drink beer. He's a manly man. Jacob's the more quiet sort of fellow. He'd rather curl up with a nice thick book in his easy chair and sip a glass of Merlot in his tent at night. Right? They're different. Now think about this. Isaac prefers his son Esau because Esau hunts and provides meat. Isaac is a man of appetites, right? He likes meat, food, perhaps some stew. Have we heard anything about stew in this story? Right? Like father, like son. So Isaac calls Esau to him. He tells him to go out to hunt, to bring in some of his favorite food, you know, his favorite food, the kind that he loves, he says. Then after Isaac finishes his meal, he's going to bless Esau. Isaac has no intention to bless his younger son, Jacob, at all. We're going to see that in the blessing that he gives to the one he thinks is Esau. But even though God had already told Rebekah that those promises must be given to Jacob, Isaac chooses to go contrary to what God has said. The fact is, Isaac is messed up. I mean, this is messed up. Isaac, the one who inherits the promises to Abraham, Isaac is attempting to oppose God here. God says, I'm going to give it to Jacob. My older son Esau gets the blessings. As if he could somehow force God here. I mean, Isaac has no intention to bless Jacob in any way. Now, he makes this plan. Esau's going to hunt. He's going to bring in some food. Then Isaac's going to bless him. Well, his wife overhears the conversation. She knows exactly what her husband's planning. But she also knows exactly what God said back in chapter 25. The younger son, Jacob, is going to be the one who inherits the blessing. Esau is going to serve Jacob. This is the perfect time, then, for her as a good, loving wife to remind her husband, hey, don't forget what God said. I know your plan is to bless Esau, but God already chose Jacob, so don't oppose God. It's a great time for her to step up and be a good wife, right? It's amazing to me how often my wife sounds like the Holy Spirit. It's not what she does, though. Did you notice in verse 8 what she calls Jacob? Now, we're going to read all these verses here, but in verse 8, she calls Jacob my son. Back in verse 1, Isaac called Esau my son. Daddy has his favorite, and Mama has her favorite. Now, Rebekah has this plan. She's going to dress Jacob up like Esau. Jacob, you know, as we've seen the descriptions of Jacob, is this smooth-skinned man who probably has no calluses on his hands, probably has a soft voice. That's my interpretation. Soft-spoken. He's going to pretend to be the much darker-skinned Esau, who's really hairy, who has calluses everywhere, probably has dirt under his fingernails, smells like sweat and animals, and probably like some blood from some of the animals he's killed. I mean, I have as much possibility of pretending to be Shaquille O'Neal. I don't know if you know who Shaq is, but the guy standing next to Shaq in this picture is taller than I am. Yeah, I'm going to dress up like Shaq by putting on his jersey. You'd never know the difference. Well, the plan involves preparing a goat. If you've ever had goat, if you've ever had venison, it was probably what he was hunting. They don't taste anything alike, right? We're talking like chicken and beef. They're different. They have a very different flavor. But see, he's going to get a goat, and he's going to dress up in Esau's clothes, and he's going to cover himself with goat skin. How hairy do you have to be for goat skin to feel like your skin? It's coarse. It's stiff. He was a hairy man. What we're seeing here is Rebekah is messed up. This isn't right. God promised that Jacob would receive the blessing, but he didn't promise that he would get it through her lying, through her deceit, of her own husband. Jacob expressed his fear in the text at being discovered, and she agrees to take whatever curses then might be placed on him on herself. Now think about this. Rebekah is the woman God chose to be the one through whom the blessings of Abraham would come, right? It was Abraham's wife, Sarah, then his son Isaac, and Isaac's wife Rebekah would be the one to bear the son through whom the covenant would come. She's willing to throw that all away so that she could get her way with her husband. She's messed up. This brings us to verse 14. So he went and took them and brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared delicious food, such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And the skins of the young goats she put on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. And she put the delicious food and the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. So he went into his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game, that your soul may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come near, that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you really are my son Esau or not." So Jacob went near his father, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. And he said, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered, "I am." Then he said, bring it near to me, that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near to him, and he ate, and he brought him wine, and he drank. So Jacob agrees to her plan. He brings her the things she asked for. She prepared the food. She dressed him in Esau's clothes. And then, wait a minute. She dressed him in Esau's clothes? Verse 15, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. I think we see a problem with Esau, or with Jacob here. If Isaac is 130 at this point, that means Jacob's 70 years old. If you're 70 and mama's still dressed in you, someone needs to man up here. So she puts the goatskins on him. Jacob goes into his father's tent, dressed like a buffoon. Goatskin wrapped around his hands and around his neck. You got to remember, Isaac has bad vision. I mean, really bad vision for this to work. It has to be pretty bad. He goes into the tent, says, "Dad, I'm here. I got the stuff you wanted." He's like, "Who are you? You sound like Jacob." "Nope, I'm Esau. Eat the food I brought you." Isaac asks him, "Well, how is it that you got this food so quickly? I mean, hunting generally takes several hours and you're back already. I'm confused here." Do you see his response? "The Lord, your God, blessed me." It's blasphemy. This is blasphemy. He's saying God is responsible for the sin I'm committing of deceiving you. I'm lying and God enabled me. He's giving God the credit for his sin. This is blasphemy. Jacob is a terrible man. Talk about messed up. This dude is the worst of the bunch. I mean, Dad Isaac is a bum who plays favorites. He attempts to stop God. His wife Rebekah is a lying manipulator. Esau is flat out lost. But Jacob is a blasphemer. He's willing to blame God for his own sin. He doesn't even acknowledge God as his own. Do you catch that? It's the Lord your God has done this. Not the Lord my God or the Lord our God. He's your God. He's not my God. We're going to see it doesn't happen for some time after this, that he's actually converted. Well, the deception works. Jacob moves near Isaac, who feels the goat skin on his back, probably cupped him, you know, on the back of the neck and felt the hair back there. Asked him again, "Are you Esau?" He lies and says he is. But the one thing that should stand out here is his voice. I mean, a dad knows the voices of his sons, particularly if one's like a really manly man. "I'm Esau." "I'm Jacob. Nice to see you." I mean, you're going to notice the difference. And yet, he says, you know, "Who are you?" "I'm Jake. I'm Esau." I mean, picture the scene here. Esau is out hunting so that Isaac can have his favorite meal. He comes back much sooner than Isaac expected, which, you know, gets his spidey sense tingling a little bit. Like, this is weird. How did you catch some animal, an animal so quickly? And then he hears the voice, and that's Jacob's voice, not Esau's voice. What's going on here? So, I mean, you got all these warning signs that something isn't right, but then it's like, "What is that I smell, Esau? Is that those venison tacos I asked for?" I mean, it was tacos, right? It was his favorite food. It had to be tacos. I mean, Isaac is willing to ignore all the warning signs because it's time to eat. And whoever this is in front of him has food. I mean, Isaac is a man of appetites. Sound familiar? Like father, like son? Isn't that what Esau did? Remember, Isaac here is messed up. So he finishes his meal and we come to verse 23. And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him and said, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered, "I am." Then he said, "Bring it near to me, and I will eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near and he eats. Okay? Verse 26. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him. And Isaac smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him. You know, if I smell a man like that, I don't know if blessing is what would come out of my mouth. But he blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you and blessed be everyone who blesses you." Now, Isaac allows his love for his son Esau to override his other senses, particularly his hearing. Jacob sounds like Jacob, and he was back far too soon to be Esau, yet he's got food. Who cares about that other stuff? We can ignore that because he has what I want, and what I want is food. In his zeal to bless Esau instead of Jacob, Isaac rushes ahead with a blessing. And what a blessing he gets. First, he blesses them with incredible prosperity. Not just prosperity of the earth, but the dew of heaven. This is divine blessing. You get all this incredible divine blessing. You're going to be prosperous. You're going to be blessed in this land. And then he promises them great authority. People are going to bow down to you. That's how great and important you're going to be. I mean, remember, God promised Abraham that kings would descend from him. That's what he's saying to Jacob here, thinking that Jacob is Esau. Nations are going to, your own brothers are going to bow down to you. That's how important you're going to be. And here comes the kicker. Anyone who curses you will be cursed, and anyone who blesses you will be blessed. You want to be blessed? The only way is to be a friend of Jacob. To be opposed to Jacob in any way means to be cursed. And this is incredible. He doesn't leave, this is such a complete blessing that he doesn't leave any room for blessing the other son. In this case, Esau, the one he thinks he's blessing. You see what Isaac is doing? He's attempting to thwart God's plan for blessing the world through Abraham's offspring, the offspring who is Jacob himself. This is Isaac doing this. Isaac is the son God promised, not Ishmael, not the six sons Abraham had with Keturah. It was Isaac God chose, and yet here is Isaac attempting to thwart God's plan. Talk about messed up. His whole family's messed up. So imagine his surprise when he discovers that he's been duped, that he has been deceived. Now, rather than read through all the text, I'm going to summarize the next several verses for you. Jacob walks out of the tent after receiving this airtight blessing. You understand, there are no notary publics back in the day. There was no one there to verify. I mean, Jacob said, "I'm Esau," and so against his better judgment, he accepted that. That means his blessing is airtight. There's no undoing this. There's no mulligan. There's no do-over, right? It's not kickball in the back lot where you got, I missed the ball. I get to do it over. Jacob leaves the tent with the blessing of his father, the promises of Abraham. So moments later, Esau comes walking in. He's like, "Hey, Dad, got these venison tacos for you." And Dad knows immediately what has happened. He's like, I know that voice. That's not Jacob now. This is Isaac, Esau. And if this is Esau, who was just here? Oh, it was that mama's boy. He tricked me. Now you got to remember, all he has to go on at this point is hearing. His eyesight's dim, which means his hearing has been sharpened. As soon as he hears the voice of Esau, he knows exactly what has happened. He also knows that there's really no room left for blessing Esau because of how tightly he blessed Jacob. Verse 37. Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Behold, I have made him lord over you. And all his brothers I have given to him, to Jacob, for servants. And with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Now he's asking, come on, you have to have something left in the tank. There's got to be some blessing that you can give me. You didn't give it all away.
Isaac's like, yeah, wait,
there's this one thing. There's one tiny thing I can do for you. Verse 39. Then Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you shall break free from his yoke from your neck. It's like there's no fatness of the earth here for Esau, because he gave it all to Isaac, or to Jacob. There's no prosperity. The earth is not going to be abundant for him. There's no dew of heaven. There are no more divine blessings available for Esau if Esau stands opposed to Jacob. But Isaac has this. He says, look, you're going to be ruled by your brother. His boot is going to be on your neck your entire life, and you're not going to have any prosperity or any blessing whatsoever. But you got this. At some point in the future, your offspring will break free from that boot. Right? There's that. I mean, it's not much of a lining, but it's a lining on the cloud. I don't know if it's silver yet, but Isaac's blessing for Jacob was so complete that there's nothing really left for Esau. And it's not until 2 Kings chapter 8 that this blessing comes true for Esau, the Edomites who descend from him. It messed up. Well, as you can imagine, the problems in the family are just beginning. Going on to verse 41. Where am I? Chapter 7. There we go. Now, Esau hated Jacob. You think? Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. But the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, behold, your brother Esau comforts himself about you by planning to kill you. Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice. Arise, flee to Laban, my brother in Haran, and stay with him a while, until your brother's fury turns away, until your brother's anger turns away from you, and he forgets what you have done to him. Then I will send and bring you from there. Why should I be bereft of both of you in one day? Now Esau is so spitting angry here, he wants to kill his twin brother. I mean, he is furious at this. He thinks it's the second time he's been cheated. Never mind the first time he actually willingly gave away his birthright for a bowl of stew. Now, Rebekah knows this. She decides to send Isaac away to her brother Laban. She thinks he's going to be safe there. Now, she should know that he's safe anywhere he is because God's promises to Jacob haven't been fulfilled yet. Jacob has to be alive for the fulfillment of them. And so there's really no danger to Jacob. She should know this. And yet, she lets her fear control her and she plots to send him away to her brother Laban for protection. Now you understand, this seems pretty straightforward. Isaac's still around. He's going to be around for another 50 years, which means he's still the head of the household. If he hears that one son is about to kill the other son, he can put a stop to it. He has authority. He's got lots of people who work for him. Remember, his father, Abraham, had a great army that chased those four kings. You remember that story? I mean, Isaac is a man of power. He can stop this murder from taking place if he wants to. I mean, surely this is the sort of thing that a husband and wife can discuss, right? Hello, dear. How's your day? Well, you got a problem here. Our one son wants to kill our other son, and you're the guy to stop this. I mean, it seems like in a marriage, that's the sort of thing you could talk about. Verse 46. Then Rebekah said to Isaac, I loathe my life because of the Hittite women. Oh, if Jacob marries one of the Hittite women like these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me? You see what's going on here? She wants to send Jacob away to her brother Laban for his safety. But what does she say to her husband? Oh, we don't want Jacob to get married here. Remember, your dad's servant was sent away to my brother Laban to bring me here. So let's do the same with Jacob. Only let's send Jacob there. Like, that's not the reason. You're afraid that your other son's going to kill him. So why the deception? Why the lie? Is it because Isaac prefers Jacob or Esau and Mama prefers Jacob? I'd be willing to bet that this has been a source of tension in the marriage for the last 70 years or so. I mean, think of this family. First, there's dear old Grandpa Abraham, who was a liar. He pimped out his wife on at least two occasions, lying and saying she was his sister and letting other men take her. God interrupted that and prevented anything bad from happening. He risked all the promises of God in order to save his own neck. That's Grandpa. He frequently questioned whether God could do what he said. Now, throughout his life, he grew in his faith and, you know, the strength of his faith. And yet, he still, from time to time, doubted God. Right? That's dear old grandpa. That's the legacy we have here. And then we see his son Isaac, who was also willing to lie about his wife. Guess where he got that from? Like father, like son. But Isaac's going to be the one through whom God is going to bless all the families of the earth. And yet, Isaac can't get along with anybody. He's got problems with the king of Gerar. He's got problems with the people of Gerar. He moves outside. He's got problems with the people in the middle of nowhere. This guy's having strife everywhere in his life. He wasn't a good father since he played favorites. He was a man of appetites, right? He was willing to ignore all the warning signs because, well, you know, food. His oldest son takes after him. He's willing to trade away his birthright for a bowl of stew. His younger son was no better. He was willing to lie and deceive dad in order to take the blessing. He's even willing to blaspheme God along the way. It's not like his wife was any better. She's willing to lie and manipulate her husband to get what she wanted. Jacob was her favorite. God promised that Jacob would get the blessing, so why not lie and deceive everybody to make that happen? You talk about a real prize. It's kind of guy, woman you want. Not really. Well, think of how messed up this family is. Now, remind yourself this. This is the family through whom God is going to bless all the families of the earth. Great plan. I mean, this is no General Hospital or Guiding Light or All My Children. This is a real-life soap opera. And it's the family God is going to use to bring about worldwide blessing. Now, I want you to think about something. There is one person in this story who could have made one minor change of decision that would have completely altered the rest of history. One person could have just made a simple choice for him, and it would have completely changed it. Now, we know the backstory here is God already chose Jacob over Esau. So here's the question. How different would things be if God had simply chosen for Jacob to be born first? I mean, if he can speak the world into existence, surely he can switch the babies around in the womb so that one comes out before the other. So why didn't he? I mean, if God had done that, if Jacob were the firstborn, then there would not have been a question about who was going to receive the birthright, the inheritance of Abraham, because the normal course of things was that the older son would receive it. And since God chose Jacob, if he were born first, that would have just eliminated the problem. That means Rebekah wouldn't have felt the need to lie and manipulate her husband to bring about this blessing. It means she wouldn't have felt the need to bring her son Jacob in on the deception of his own father. Jacob wouldn't have cheated Esau out of anything. Isaac wouldn't have felt the need to try to rush ahead with his own plan. Because he would have, okay, Jacob's the older one. He gets the blessing. There wouldn't have been any concern. So why wasn't Jacob born first? God is sovereign. God is sovereign, which means even when he allows things to happen according to, you know, the design of things, he's still in control of them. I mean, God created weather patterns, and they occur according to his design, and yet God is able to sovereignly interrupt and bring rain or bring drought or any other weather phenomena that he wants to bring. He can do that. He would be sovereign if Jacob were born first, and Jacob would naturally inherit the blessings. But he's also sovereign by overturning the natural order of things. See, what God is doing here is demonstrating that he is actively sovereign by making people uncomfortably aware of his choices. By having Jacob born second and yet choosing Jacob to receive the inheritance, God is making this family aware that he is sovereign, that he is God, and none of them are. There's only one God, and it's not them. God is the one who is in control of all things. That's what he's reminding them. We have to keep in mind, though, God is not the author of sin. Now, God uses it to bring about his purposes, as we're seeing in this story. But God did not make Esau sell his birthright for a bowl of stew. God did not make Rebekah lie and deceive and manipulate her husband. God did not make her husband choose food over listening to that nagging voice in the back of his mind. God did not make Jacob blaspheme his way to the blessing. Now, the outcome of all those things is that God brought about the blessing to Jacob. But God is not the one who caused them to do these things. One thing this teaches us is if you stand opposed to God, if you attempt to stop God's plan, then you're going to get played. You can't do it. You can't stop God from doing what God is going to do. God is too clever. God is too powerful. God is simply too awesome to be thwarted by the likes of you or the likes of me. We can't stand opposed to him. There's nothing we can do. The question, again, this keeps coming up, is why would God call a man like Abraham to be the one through whom God would bless the world? Why would God call his son Isaac, who's no better than Abraham, to become the one through whom his family of Abraham would descend? And why would God choose Jacob, who's a blasphemer? Well, there's lots of reasons. We could probably talk about this for hours, but I think this is what I think the most important reason is for God choosing to use a messed up family like the family of Abraham. No one can boast. There is no one in the story who can say, God is blessing the world because of me. Look what I've done. Look what I've accomplished. Look at my faithfulness. Look how godly I am. Look how righteous my life is. This is why God is doing this. No one in the story. No one in Abraham's family can make that claim. Not a single one of them. And since no one can make that claim, then the ultimate result of that is God is the one who gets the glory for it. When it actually works out the way it's supposed to, God is the one who gets the credit. Here's how the Apostle Paul explained it in his letter to the church at Ephesus. He says, "For by grace you have been saved through faith. And this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God, not of works, so that no one can boast." In other words, when God does the great work that He does in this world, neither you nor I nor we as a church can claim the credit for it. We can't brag about being the reason God is doing this great work in Grand Rapids. We can't brag about being the reason that our lives have changed. That's why we don't give a faith story and say, I've changed my life. No, you haven't. God did. You've messed your life up. God's the one who comes along and cleans it up. Give Him the credit. Now, we've seen in Paul's letter to the Galatians that all those who are trusting in Jesus, followers of Jesus, are the very offspring promised to Abraham. What that means is, if you are a follower of Jesus, who's your daddy? Abraham. Like father, like son. Keep in mind, the apple does not fall far from the tree. This is your family we're talking about. You know, I read an article recently that described healthy churches as messy churches. A healthy church is one in which there's a lot of spiritual immaturity, which leads to messiness, right? Because there are so many new believers. But also because there are so many older believers who have finally given up pretending to be something that they're not, and they're authentic about the fact that they're fallen and broken too. Look, you're a new Christian. You make mistakes. I'm an old Christian. And guess what I do? I'm a mess. I've been following Jesus for like 26 years now. I'm a mess. God cleans up messes. I got to tell you, as a pastor, I get to see a lot of the sins you guys struggle with. I hear about them, you share them with me, I pray for you, right? The elders, we're involved. If messy churches are healthy churches, hear me, if messy churches are healthy churches, then New City has it going on. I mean, when I look around, as a pastor, one of the elders of the church, I see a group of people who are struggling with pride and arrogance and laziness and gluttony and lust and jealousy and apathy. And that's just the elders. I haven't gone to you people yet. We're sinners. We got problems and we need Jesus to fix those problems. We have to be careful that we as a church don't look down on other churches because we do things differently. And we do. If you've been part of another church, you know that things are very different here at New City. How we go about the ministry, we have a different approach. Also keep in mind that we don't have 100 years of history holding us back. Right? Keep in mind that Berean Baptist and Crescent Christian Reformed and Fourth Reformed and Calvary Undenom and Crossroads Bible, those churches are no less messy than New City, and New City is no less messy than they are. We're all in this together. We all serve the same Jesus who came to clean up the same sorts of messes. We all need Him. The fact is, whenever God is working, there is a mess that He's busy cleaning up, and that mess is us. We are the mess. We are the problem. Here's the great hope in all of this. The great hope is that God uses some of the greatest messes in the world to accomplish His greatest work. Here's what the book of Acts has to say about this. Peter's preaching. He says, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst." In other words, there's no one that can deny who Jesus is based on the miracles he performed. Those aren't ordinary sorts of miracles, right? As if there were such a thing. "This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death, because it was not possible for him to be held by it." The greatest act of defiance of God in the history of the world was the betrayal of Judas, or of Jesus, by Judas. The greatest attempt to thwart the plan of God in this world was the murder of God's Son. And yet, what do we see? Easter Sunday, death got played. Not even death itself could stop the plan of God in this world. Jesus defeated death. So here's my encouragement for us today on this, the third anniversary of our launch as a church. Stay faithful. Stay faithful. Continue following Jesus no matter what it costs you. Continue sharing His good news with your friends and neighbors and your coworkers and your families. No matter how messed up you are. No matter how immature you are in your faith. No matter how much drama you create in your life. God is at work in you and through you. That's great hope. God uses messes to do great things. We want to grow. We want to mature. We want to become less dramatic, right? We want to clean ourselves, or not ourselves, but to be cleaned up by God. That's our goal. But don't let immaturity and don't let messiness stop you from doing what God is calling us to do. So don't run away from messy people. Don't run away from messy people, because if you did, you wouldn't be here. Right? You couldn't be around me. Get involved with messy people. Stay involved. Remember, God got involved with us. We're the mess, right? Don't be afraid to be around the mess that people create, because we have the solution to the mess. We have the answer to the problem, right? Was it the line in Eric's song? He's the answer to the only question? How does it go? The only answer to the only question. We have that answer. We know what the question is, and we have the answer to it. So don't be afraid of the mess that people are in. God came to clean us up. He came to change us, and He's doing so through the relationships God has placed us in. So let's commit ourselves as a church this coming year and in the decades to come. Let's commit ourselves to doing the mission God has given us. Let's make disciples, knowing that that happens in relationship. Repeat after me. Discipleship happens in relationship. That's how we do it. That means we're in messes. We're in the drama of one another's lives. Let's continue to do the work God has called us to do, knowing that the good news of Jesus continues to change us. He continues to undo the mess. The fact is, God promised Abraham that He would bless the entire world through Abraham's offspring, and that promised offspring is Jesus. Jesus came to this world at the right time in history. He came to live the life that not one of Abraham's other descendants would live. And He also came to die the death under the wrath of God that not one of Abraham's other descendants could die. He did that for the sins of His people. See, Jesus came to save sinners, which means in order to do this, He calls sinners to be His people. Messed up people get to be participants in the great plan of God. That's amazing to me. Case in point, He called me to plant this church 3 years ago. This is the wonder of God. God can take the weakest and the frailest and absolutely worst person and use him to do great things. See, God is at work in Grand Rapids, and He's doing some of that work through us right here at New City Church. So let's honor God with our lives. Let's live for Him in all things. Let's remember that when Jesus takes messed up people and Jesus does great things with those messed up people and through those messed up people, then Jesus and Jesus alone gets the glory. Because there's no other way to explain it. Let's be His people. Let's be faithful to the gospel. Let's be faithful to live for Jesus, recognizing that we're going to create messes and we're going to have to work through them together. But let's be faithful to Jesus and be His people right here in this place.